Experiencing it, even the United States. And you know what we do, and I think that one cannot resolve it as a country alone. You simply can't. You need to do it in a group. The G20, the European Parliament, you know, you need these broader blocks, if I can put it that way. And it's become a very serious instrument with which to get funds up, isn't simply out of the country, and some funds legally out, but abusing the very taxation system that is there. And, you know, it has had a very, very serious impact on us, notwithstanding that our taxation, our revenue regulatory framework, is one of the finest in the world in our nation. But notwithstanding that, we have this challenge. And let me allow Honourable Williams just to put final word in on this.
Thank you, Chair. No, I'll be very brief. Fundamentally, just to repeat what the Chair said, when we first engaged on this matter, we really did think that it was an African phenomenon, fundamentally, which, you know, with a big multinational company coming into Africa, digging up our raw materials and leaving with all the profits. And we were really stunned that it's, I mean, it's happening to you. I mean, it's unbelievable. The figures must be astounding. I mean, our figures are really big. That's been estimated in the Becky report. It was a report by, So that was really astounding figures. Now yours must be even worse. I mean, surely we must be able to work together to deal with this, because it is really bad for developmental goals. Very good for exploited capitalists, but it's very bad for us. Anyway, thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Williams. And I think we need to come back to that. Our own report here will be tabled in Parliament sometime this year. And to share that with each other, because that's what a strategic partnership is all about. So thank you, Co-Chair.
What is immoral? If you're a big company, a multinational company, you want to be in touch with protein infrastructure, with the good workforce, with a functioning legal system. And if you don't want to pay for that, well, that is a bad thing. And I've learned that, I'm a big market here, but I've learned that so many companies don't pay tax. And that should end. We can discuss then how much and how high, but that's a different discussion.
Well, it's really quite enlightening to hear a man who has come from the private sector, who's practiced business, etc., he's in free marketing, as quite openly sharing that one with us. But I do think there are a number of business people who do share this approach. I mean, in Britain itself, Prime Minister Cameron has complained of it. So that came as a surprise to me myself. Of course, there may be different angles to it, but you know, the principle is there. But unless we get carried away in terms of our portfolio committee, let me come back to the SADU. Ah, yes, Burundi. I'm sure all of us were looking at TV, listening to radio, etc. this morning, and really, you know, I think in the final analysis, where this has a long genesis, this particular thing. In fact, wherever you tackle a complex problem, you know that the genesis of it is challenging. And our own understanding and briefings on this indicate that with the Arusha Agreement in 2000, going back 15 years, what South Africa, Angola, not Angola, Tanzania and Kenya were able to do with the aid support and their various countries' support was to work with Burundi. In fact, it was late President Mandela, Thabo Mbeki himself, in 2000 to 1994, and so he was still very much around. And in 1999, and then of course he even continued while leaving the presidency to provide support as an envoy in this regard. And it's quite interesting that later this leadership role from South Africa in that regard, former President Mbeki appointed now the current state president Zuma to continue with those negotiations. And as executives recognized South Africa was an able negotiator, he turned out to be for Africa's benefit. And they were able, South Africa, Tanzania, and Kenya, working with all parties in Burundi, to manage to craft out a negotiated settlement. That's the first thing. And from that settlement, you then got the current president on board, which perhaps for most of us, we did see as a first term, you know, without delving into the actual constitution or judicial issues or legal. So it was just assumed, then, well, that's the first term, you see. And then the second term went ahead, so we called it. We only realized last year, perhaps a little earlier, that this was actually regarded by the majority party there as only a first term. Because the first one was not an election. I think I just pointed that out. Unlike in South Africa, we had a negotiated settlement, then we had an election. Unlike in other countries, you negotiate a settlement, then you have an election. So, given that they had not been elected, had not gone to polls, the view, the prevailing view from the president and his party was that they can't count that as the first term. The so-called second term was the first term. And now, still within the constitution, we are moving into the second term. So there it is, and that was, in fact, it went to the High Court of Burundi, which ruled that yes, that was correct. This would be incoming as a second term. So that was the interpretation from the High Court. And the EAC, the African community, yes, you know, all of us, some of you may be lawyers, I know, Advocate Mohammed Tashkent, Jidia, you know, you wouldn't have so many lawyers if there were so many different interpretations of the Constitution. They'd all be out of work. What would you need a lawyer for? Because there's the Constitution, you see. So anyway, that they had, and the challenge became perhaps the countries all around, and certainly the AU of its recent summit, is trying to promote two terms, trying to avoid this third term situation, whether it is some interpretation or whatever. And that was only recently, you know, in June. And the AU and South Africa's part of the AU, the EAC, made every endeavour to say we respect the High Court ruling, this is a sovereign state. However, don't you think you could wait a few months before going to an election? Just in the interest, you know, of free and fair and enabling everyone to have their say. But clearly, the Burundian government did not agree and indeed went to elections on the 21st, as we all aware. And as we are also aware, counting is in the process of continuing and no one will know the results before we close this particular meeting as we sit here. But what the AU has done, what the EAC has done in South Africa, is at least to persuade what certainly the current president appears to be going into this next term, that really there needs to be serious consideration given to what South Africa called once a government of national unity, which we found was the best way to go after the challenges, the struggle that had been experienced and people had gone through. But this, of course, is a sovereign state. We have, you know, put our views there. Please, why don't you include other members of the opposition in the cabinet, in these places, etc. Now, whether or not that will be heeded, sitting here, we don't know. We really don't. I'll just ask, Mr. Makaya, if you keep the radio close to your ear and the cabinet, could you tell us if you're adding? Let's add for anything you can.
Thank you very much, Chair. First, who? What is the probably the anticipated way forward? Why is the president of Burundi is going to emerged victorious in this election. There's no doubt about that. And for South Africa, working with the EAC, we'll be involved in some dialogue with him together with the opposition parties, which is exactly what the chair was saying, to try to form an inclusive government. President Museveni would be leading that process. He started that a few days before the election. He had to halt that process because there was no cooperation. The second important thing is that we want the violence in Burundi to stop. And that violence is one because this can happen not only in Bujumbura, but also the same violence on the border with Rwanda. That's one. And then thirdly, we would expect that the refugees, the reported 170,000 refugees that have fled the country, would have to go back. They are scattered over the region, some in Tanzania, Rwanda, and Uganda, and they have to go back. We'd expect, therefore, that the continent, in particular the EAC, would work with the EU to ensure that that happens. So that we're quite grateful that the EU has committed some money, over 200 million, we're told, euro, to assist the refugees go back. But I think last week, then the Commission and the honorable members of Parliament, the issue of Burundi should not be taken in isolation. You just have to look at what's going on in that region. What's going on in the DRC, what's going on in Rwanda, what's going on in Uganda, in Congo Brazzaville. So you need to adopt a regional perspective. Because what appears to be happening there is an attempt by the city presidents to change the constitution to allow themselves to continue. As the chair was saying, that the AU has got a particular position on that. We wouldn't want the constitution to be changed to allow city presidents to continue to be in the office. However, if that process is done constitutionally and legally, council concerned, there's an action then too. I thought I just needed just to put that in the way of assistance. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Matthias. Let me just look around. Anyone can add if they wish, but my final comments would be where we are, whether it is the United States election, one remembers that election with President Bush and the court had decided who was president in the end, which is a very rare issue. But then it can happen anywhere. The thing is, we're all concerned in global, political, economic, all of us. And that's why we take a deep interest in what's going on in our regions and our countries. But perhaps what we need also to keep in mind is that all of us on our groups, Burundi, etc., regionally, globally, but we, you know, and we say we don't like third termers in early democracies, etc. Especially when democracy is not mature and so on and so forth. But it is puzzling when one sees that the Rwandan government is able to change their constitution, no problem with that, but it then brings in third term. There's not the slightest murmur from anyone on that front. It seems if it's Rwanda, it's okay to change in 2-3 terms. And I think this goes back to what you said, Honourable Stolian, when you spoke about the Greek issue and so on. Sometimes when something is left to slide, the principle of sorts, and it's done so by particular power, then it becomes easier for others to also slide down that road, as it were. So I would really appeal to all of us that we need to be alert to this sort of thing, not when the crisis develops, but before the crisis develops. And what can we do to, you know, underpin good governance principles, democracy, etc.? So I don't know if you want to comment, Honourable Van Baarden, before we move to the next issue.
I will give a minute or four to Catherine Beerder. I will say that as European Union, but I voice my own opinion, we cannot change the whole world. So we have to see indeed if an African country has a problem, that is better that the African Union or South Africa or whatever bilateral coming together can solve the problem. We are the policemen of the world and we shouldn't be this. It depends also, of course, on the human rights situation. If it's only an interpretation of the law, whether this is the second or third term, but it should also be looked at the development of the country, etc. I'll give the floor to Catherine, please.
Thank you. Just the second what Sir Hunter has just said, we're not the policemen, but we do watch with increasing concern, I think, because when you have a country that is going through this sort of project, it destabilizes the whole region, because you will have people fleeing from there, you will have, you have a running sore, it infects the whole area. I think what it comes down to is I like the idea of the African Union's two-term policy and trying to do that, but actually that's not the real issue. What is the real issue is governance. It's how you govern the country, and I think that is the real concern for us, is that we have a stifling of journalists, the opposition is being stifled, we have gangs on the street attacking citizens, and a whole violent uprising in the communities, which is destabilizing, which is driving back into old tribal violence, which we saw, of course, in Rwanda some years ago. And I think the fact that so many countries, including the EU, have pulled out of their electoral observation missions, so many humanitarian missions have gone. And I think I'm not one to talk about coming from a democracy. I mean, I rail against my own democratic system, where we have a fully appointed upper chamber, politically appointed upper chamber. But it's actually what, you know, does the population buy into this governance, and do they do it for the human rights, and do you actually have respect for the citizens and have tolerant society? And a clear and vocal opposition. And I think that's what's the real concern for us, whether it's the second or the third term that lawyers determine. But for us, the real concern is that it is descending into what we think of as old Africa. And I know that this is an issue for Africa to help us solve, because you are most affected by it. But I think we as friends of Africa in the European Union will try to help where we can, and recognise that other countries are also watching this, the King of Asha, who, if Burundi gets away with it, then there are others that may well try. So it's not an easy situation.
Other members, as you know, both the European Union and the United States are thinking about sanctions. We should, I think, in the European Parliament look very well at this issue. I don't say that we shouldn't do that, but we should pretty much be in coordination with you and see what is the best solution of the problem. But I think we more or less agree that if African Union or South Africa or other countries can solve the problem, maybe also with some help us, that would be preferable than that we only do it from Washington or from Brussels. But let's look how the things develop. And how do you look on the idea of sanctions?
I'm never a great fan of sanctions, because the most simplistic form of sanctions hurt the most vulnerable, generally. But there are other sorts of sanctions, and sanctions against individuals, as we're doing with Russia at the moment, and I think well-targeted sanctions, maybe, but blanket sanctions is never really the most helpful. I think in diplomatic terms we should be helpful, not destructive. And I think sanctions with a sledgehammer tend to be that way.
Yes, and then we've had that exchange, and certainly give us a clearer understanding of the view, the position of the European Union in this area. Thank you so much, co-chair. Now we come to Sudan and so on, and the president there, of course, the Honourable Ali Bashir, and so on, has been there for some time. But of course, we are also all of us aware that the conflict and the challenges in that area are less than they were in some years back, because there are shifts and moves by the AU, South Africa, and others to try and, through influence, begin to generate other responses. And the issue is really, we indeed, as many members of you are aware, we are signatories of the Rome Statute, and not everyone is. And within the Rome Statute, it requires that when certain people are identified, then there needs to be a process of arrest and a court process that will look at the matter. But we also know from the ICC's own pronouncements that the original charges, if one wants to put it that way, that have been put forward have been considerably reduced. And as I said to you, I'm not sure what they currently stand at the moment. But we are, South Africa has always been a strong supporter of good governance, law, and that's why we were one of the first to sign that statute. And we believe in the principle of multilateralism and so on. And we are aware, and we share with the European community, the international community, that there are certain crimes, serious crimes that we are concerned about, and that does need an effective process. The other issue, though, of course, back to back with that, one thing to prosecute, it's another. If your overriding vision for a continent, for a region, for the world, is that you want peace, development, and stability, how do you reach that? Now, we saw that with world wars, where the First World War and the settlement led directly to the Second World War. Consequently, other measures were put in place. It helped them. It helped them get on their feet, as it were. You know, free loans, etc. Now, that kind of thing did bring about peace, stability, and in fact did too as well, and in the formation of the European Union. Now, we in South Africa, since new democracy, new dispensation, our route has been reconciliation. We are all brothers and sisters at the end of the day. Let us try and work together as fellow South Africans. Yes, you oppressed us. We are, you know, you're the oppressors, we are the oppressed. Well, why don't we have the Nuremberg trials? That was not yet to be an option. We would never have had the development we've got today if we'd gone that route. I can tell you, we would probably still be in a flood loss and maybe unsettled the rest of Africa in the process. And it arises from that, you know, Tamarin, you actually mentioned that we ought to think of the vulnerable people first. That's why you don't just say sanctions. Think very carefully, so targeted what kind of sanctions. And me too, when it came to our own country, we put ordinary people first. I remember Tata Sulu, one of our great leaders, said when he came out of prison, he said, are you going to nationalise everything? You know, we've seen your ANC policy, all the children. Well, when are you nationalising them? When are you doing this? And he said, no, look, there's an overriding commitment. If you look at the Freedom Charter, it is put people first. And if it comes to people and ideology, it's people you must consider for the final analysis. So we do want to encourage regional initiatives, as Mr. Mackay has said, in to basically close neighbours, to directly address them, to be encouraged through persuasion. No country has ever changed in the long term sustainably through military intervention. No country. Not just the Greco-Romans and the Ethiopians long before that and other civilizations. I'm going to the caveman for the same thing. You will never achieve a sustainable settlement or peace or development through military means or others. So it was on that basis, and mindful of the fact, our commitment to good governance and democracy is underpinned by many things. Among them, we are members of the AU. Among them, the Pan-African Parliament, People's Parliament is right here. And of course, we really sacrificed our own stalwart great leader, Dr. Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma. We could ill afford to lose the leadership in this country, but we released her and supported the move for her to be elected as the chairperson of the AU. And I tell you now, there's a lot more good government there. And perhaps one other issue one would like to point out is that we are, and I want to emphasize, we are pursuing vigorously regional integration, and that's what is playing and is a key platform that facilitates infrastructural development on the continent. And we've got the African Renaissance and International Cooperation Front, democracy, good governance again. But lest I exhaust your questions you may have had in mind, let's simply say this. Would you seek to balance our international obligations with those of the continent? And we also have to take into account, again, many, many other issues around humanity. Our soldiers were there, peacekeeping force, hundreds of them there, not with any weaponry to withstand what happened in Kaa. We all know what happened there, the Central African Republic. We went there as a peacekeeping training group, and we buried our soldiers here. And we were not prepared to allow that again. And no statesman can allow that to happen. So it was a careful balance of consideration that I myself am not privy to, as I sit here. I doubt any member of GERCO is either for that matter. But I think that in fairness to all the members of the group, we ought to allow them to speak if they wish. Let me reiterate. Government's position, Parliament's position is a very clear one. We respect law and order, the promotion of good governance and institutional systems that will provide an environment for democracy and good governance. I don't know, I'm looking around. Yes, Honourable Waters.
Thank you, Chair. And before I start, I can just say, I think in a democracy, it's healthy to have different views, and there's nothing to be seen in the negative light if people do have conversion or different views from each other. And I do have great respect for the chief of CNOs, and I think she's been put in a very difficult position trying to defend the indefensible here. If I may just say to that in the beginning, and just to also, before I get into the meat of what I'm about to say, I mean, the Honourable Club says we need to balance obligations. The fact of the matter is we are signatories of the Rome Statute, we are a member of the ICC, and we need to fulfil those obligations. And we cannot compromise on those as far as we, obviously for my part, and our Democratic Alliance. We have to fulfil those obligations. We cannot tiptoe around them, and we cannot cherry pick what obligations we want to enforce or we don't want to enforce. It was interesting that Honourable Fox also mentioned about thinking about safety, about troops, about peacekeeping troops in Sudan, which obviously we do have to. There was reports in the media that before the president of Sudan, one could say departed, one could say fled, one could say escaped from South Africa, whichever adjective you'd like to use. the troops were what some people call were intimidated by Sudanese troops that they were surrounded in their tents. That was denied by the government, but if it has been raised in this forum, I think there must be some truth to that thing. So if I can just start, you know, Honorable, the late President Mandela said that our, when talking about our foreign affairs policy, that our, as a country, our belief that human rights should be the core concern of our international relations, and that considerations of justice and respect for international law should guide the relationship between nations. So he's clearly stated that back in 1993, and we have deviated from those very principles, we believe, when we allowed the President of Cincinnati to escape arrest. Just to give you some background, the President of Sudan fled the country on the 15th of June. This is after cabinet had taken a decision to grant him immunity from arrest. We believe the cabinet has no such authority to give that to make that decision. Mm. On the 14th of June, the court, the South African court issued an interim order to arrest the President of Sudan, which cabinet deliberately ignored, we believe. And I think it's sub judice. I'm hearing it's all sub judice. We get told that a lot. Sub judice, you can't talk about anything but can, as long as you don't try to influence the outcome of a court decision. On the 15th of June, the day that the President actually fled South Africa, a full bench of the North South Kingdom Court declared the conduct of the Ministers of Justice and Constitutional Development, the Ministers of Peace, the Minister of International Relations and Cooperation, the Minister of Home Affairs, and the respective DGs to be inconsistent with the Constitution of the Republic of South Africa, and the actions to be invalid. In fact, following the 15th of June order, the court considered whether the cabinet resolution, coupled with the ministerial notice, are capable of suspending South Africa's duty to arrest the head of state against whom the ICC has issued a warrant. And remember, there were two warrants out for the president's arrest. The court found as follows: that the actions of the executive in allowing President Bashir to leave the country on the 15th of June were in clear violation of the 14th of June's court order. Neither the Immunities Act in line with the June Agreement, nor his status as head of the state according to the General Convention on the Privileges and Immunities of the OAU confer immunity on the President. The Rome Statute expressly provides the head of state not to enjoy immunity under customary international law. Similarly, the implementation aspect of immunity, which would otherwise have been attached to the President as head of the state, is excluded and waived in respect of crimes and obligations under the Rome Statute. The Implementation Act, which was domesticated versus OAU convention, which was not, represents a clear decision by the legislature not to confer blanket immunity on AU bodies, meetings and officials that attend them. Decisions of the AU cannot, and I repeat, cannot stump South Africa's obligations under the Rome Statute. That's very important. And that the Rome Statute gives effect to international human rights laws and enables the prosecution of customary international law crimes. So quite clearly, the court has ruled that the government was in contravention of two court orders, in fact. And this has been used as an excuse that the government said that the IC, the composition of it, is questionable, let's put it that way. If Serbia has an issue with the composition of the IC, they should then withdraw from that body first, and not simply ignore rulings and warrants of arrest by the IC. The fact that we have signatories to the Rome Statute obliges us to fulfill our obligations and to arrest anybody that comes in South Africa where a warrant of arrest has been issued. And for serious crimes, it's not just minor crime. They're very, very serious crimes to do with genocide, rape, displacement of people. These are very serious crimes. And if we are as a country basing our international relations policy on the principle of human rights, then we should have arrested the President of Sudan.
Can you now just use that? That's it. If you find the official opposition. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Waters, Honourable Dudley.
Thank you. The African Christian Democratic Party obviously, our view is that the commitment to the Rome Statute should have been respected, and of course the court order upheld the rule of law cannot be undermined. And not only in South Africa, but in Africa in general, it is something that we need to model, to strengthen rather than to undermine. However, we have to keep in mind as well that there would be no new South Africa if there was no compromise. And I hear the DA talking about no compromise, no compromise, no compromise. And any relationship, I mean, there would be no marriage between my husband and me if there was no compromise. So compromise is a critical factor at every level. And political solutions must trump military solutions. And complex issues do need very sensitive handling for the good of everybody concerned, because we're trying for us sitting up in our ivory towers, but it's not a fine for people on the ground who are actually going to deal with the fallout. So this is a complex issue that can't be reduced to a simple no compromise. And at the same time, we should have done everything in our power in that situation at that time to uphold our commitment to the Rome Statute and see that the court order was upheld. And what we did before that or after that, in terms of the rule of law, should have been taken care of. Clearly, it wasn't at the time, and so Kwasi's management came into play. So this is not an ideal situation, but it is one that we can't reduce to cliché. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Dudley. Is anyone else wanting? Honourable Williams?
Chairperson. I think it's very important for everybody to realise that obviously this is a very tricky situation. And as Honourable Dudley said, we make decisions here in our ivory towers, and meanwhile on the ground, people getting killed. South Africa's approach is to the African, you know, our African situation is reconciliation and the pursuit of peace and stability. Now, although we didn't arrest the president when he was in South Africa, if we had arrested him, the instability that would have created would have not only killed lots and lots, thousands of people, probably would have died, but also it would have put South Africa out of any negotiations that we could ever go in there and try and bring about peace and stability. And we must bear this in mind. So I think that we would argue it was for the greater good of humanity that we did not arrest that individual. In the future, obviously, we're going to work for the betterment of the people there, and obviously there will be actions taken at a later stage. But for the interest of peace and stability within the region, South Africa did the best thing they could under the circumstances. Thank you.
Where is that hand? Right, just briefly then, Honourable Mackay.
Chair, I think we need to recognise the fact that South Africa put itself in this position. We did not need to extend an invitation to Algiers to attend South Africa. We could have invited the delegates who were not voted by the IAT. So when we start talking about all the options that we need to integrate with, these sort of arguments are slippery slopes that were used and have been used throughout history by some very strange people to do some very Christian things. So the fact of the matter that this government took an active decision to invite Mr. Bashir to South Africa to attend the conference. In previous occasions, South Africa has not extended the invitation to Mr. Bashir to attend any conferences in South Africa. So we have to recognize that something has changed in the current administration from previous administrations within South Africa. And this is a blatant statement by the South African government of impunity to the International Criminal Court. And we cannot pretend it is anything but that. So that is the official, well, that's the official opposition view that we have heard incorrectly. And you did say that this is one of the issues that we would not be making a united front on. There are distinct differences between political parties. But however, I do think we should be clear that the government invited the division to South Africa. It did not need to do so. And the fact that it did so, means that it was always going to take its course of action.
Thank you, Honourable Mackay. I think perhaps what should be underlined from our side, while we may disagree with certain elements here, there's one thing we all do agree on. The South African delegation, that we in fact have a multi-party democracy. People have the freedom to express themselves openly, and that there will always be some issues where you will not get unanimity on, and we respect that, of course. But what I do wish to say, the matter of Sudan, is this. there are three things that need to be kept in mind. And one is that no, South Africa did not issue the invitation to the AU. We are not there to do that. That was issued by the AU. However, we were a host country. So it was not issued by South Africa in the same way that it isn't America that issues the invitations from the United Nations, and so on and so forth. So we need to keep that sort of component in mind when we speak of international law. The second thing is, yes, indeed, the matter is sub judice, yes. However, what one must, brief our European colleague on, is the fact that at this point in time, and those of you who have legal background know, once a position is put there by the court, it is subject to a response of the plaintiff. And so what has happened now, the state president, at this moment, we are informed officially that he has made a statement, state president, on behalf of the government in respect of the issues raised, indicating X and Y, which I think you have heard vaguely expressed here by the Honourable Waters about the actual position of the court. So until that process, the court is pronounced on that per se, then we don't have a final position on the matter as we sit here. So that is the reality under the legal system that prevails in our country, notwithstanding political positions in that particular regard. But yes, it has proved to be a contentious issue in the political arena, and let me leave it there. And as I hand over the chair, let me indicate first and foremost, it would not be the first time South Africa has opposed the issue of the arrest of sitting presidents while they are trying to establish peace and development. A case in point is the current president of Kenya, which a lot of countries supported. So I want to leave it there. We've heard what all parties present here have to say, and we do need from our side to indicate they have that right to say it, and we need to respect that. But let us hand over to our co-chair.
I think for me and for us, it is very important to see how on your side there is a real political discussion. And indeed, it's not on front, but people have their own position on international law. Unfortunately, I'm an international lawyer. I've studied at Leiden University, and I've looked into cases like the Yugoslavia Tribunal, the International Criminal Court, etc. And my position is that, again, we will all get the opportunity to voice our ideas that if a country signs an international treaty, establishing international tribune, is committed to that. In my country, international treaties are part of Dutch law, so they have direct effect. So if we look at the Bashir case, my humble position, first as a lawyer, would be that South Africa should have prevented Bashir to leave the country. Then we have the political considerations about how to bring peace to societies. In Yugoslavia, in Serbia, in the end, the government, a freely and fairly elected government, handed Milosevic over to the Yugoslavia Tribunal, because they were of the opinion that if Milosevic would stay in country, real peace amongst the population was not possible. That's the position. You have had courage to have in your own country truth and reconciliation, because you decided not to bring everybody to court, but to bring the society together. We've seen processes like that also in Latin America. We have also seen in Argentina that they first had a punto final, and then the population, years after, 20 years after, wanted to bring at least international law and feelings develop. I think the big issue is, if you want to have peace, you have to negotiate with your enemy. You have not to negotiate with your friends if you want to have peace. So how to negotiate with leaders who, to my opinion, not legal opinion, but are war criminals, but they can bring peace. There's terrible discussion, and I'm happy that my country didn't have the test in this. You had to test you to have your own way. I would like not to make this a Russian issue between us, because there could be very many opinions on our side of the bench, and I would like to ask those who want to speak from the European side indicate that, and I can give the floor to those who want it. Who would like to intervene on this issue? Mr. Zala.
Shortly, I'm happy that Chairman mentioned the court for the former Yugoslavia, because it was a very important shift in the consciousness that something must be punished, and that impunity is something what is not accepted in the Europe as well. That is the most important message we send. Sometimes I read in the newspaper or in the documents that some African countries and the African Union as a whole sometimes complain that the ICC is too much focused on the African countries and the African atrocities, but it's only optical problem, because you are looking only the ICC, but there is more other courts which are hunting the atrocities and are established on the regional position and not on the ICC. And the tribunal, international tribunal against the atrocities in the former Republic of Yugoslavia, was very active, and it's necessary to take into account that they sentenced almost 20 people and the court hunting them 15 years. And hunting, really, really hunting. That was a very detective activity. And what was the positive result was the evidence that there is no a region where the hand of the justice is not able to go. That is very important to put it in the consciousness of the all rulers, all the people which are violating the law, and especially the people which are making the crimes against the humanity, because that is the case in some African countries as well, and that's something what is not justifiable. There are a lot of different crimes, but the crimes against the humanity is very, very, very important. And I think that is something what changed the situation in their countries as well. In Serbia, in Croatia, in Bosnia and Herzegovina, the situation changed when they saw, all the people, that the justice doesn't know the limits, the borders. That is important, and in this case, I appreciate the position of the International Court in Hague in case of Yugoslavia, because no one escaped from the hands of this justice. And I think this awareness is very, very necessary for Africa as well, and South Africa played a big role in this question.
Thank you very much. Are there others who want to come in? Okay. Again, we will look what the end of the process in South Africa is, what the courts will tell us, what their verdict is. And again, from international law, it's extremely interesting. Maybe I want to return to law, because it's great. From politics, it's more difficult. But again, thank you for a very open discussion amongst your sides. I thank you very much for that.
Thank you, Honourable Co-Chair. Really, and clearly, this is something we will take forward in the years ahead. Of our partnership, strategic partnership, the issues that we need to unpack here and share with each other. Thank you very much. Let us turn to the Democratic Republic of Congo. I'm going to ask the Honourable Williams to immediately come in here.
Thank you, Chairperson. Okay. The DRC presently faces a challenging political future in terms of whether it will be able to successfully meet the challenges of holding and joint provincial and local and municipal elections in 2015 and the presidential and legislative elections in 2016. Last month, the guarantors of the peace, security and cooperation framework for the DRC and the region held a second meeting. And this meeting noted slow progress of the implementation of the commitments of the PSE framework and stressed the urgent need for renewed efforts by all parties to address the challenges facing the DRC. With regard to South Africa, despite the eradication of the formidable M23 threat in 2013 with South Africa's direct assistance as part of the Force Intervention Brigade, the MIB, the Eastern DRC remains unstable and beset with challenges of multiple armed groups. Now, South Africa is committed to the objectives of SADC Collective, which supports the DRC and the Great Lakes region in achieving peace, stability, and economic development. And we wish to reiterate our unwavering commitment to the elimination of all negative forces in the DRC. South Africa considers the early and full implementation of the Nairobi Declaration, agreed upon in December 2013, as vital in bringing a speedy conclusion to this conflict. We recognize the peace and security and cooperation framework for the Democratic Republic of Congo and the region should be the guideline instrument to achieving peace in this region. And that's it, thank you.
Yeah, well, that was quite comprehensive for a summary. Right, thank you. Honorable Mackay?
Yeah, I think the point we need to raise is just that a prosperous Africa will be built on a prosperous DRC, and South Africa's invested very heavily, for at least 20 years in the DRC project. And we are very aware of the need to have a prospering DRC, and as such, Parliament took the step not to ratify the grand interdreaty between the DRC and ourselves, which we believe is a major economic stimulant to the development in that country, while also providing South Africa with a renewable source of energy, electricity, not only to South Africa, but more broadly in the region. And therefore, I think it's just always key to emphasize that we invested very much in this relationship. We do express some concern about potential political jockeying and potential violence in the run-up to legislative and presidential elections, as might become the case. And that we remain concerned about the situation, obviously, in the Eastern DRC, which then has an impact on Rwanda and Burundi, and that whole sort of part of that whole area. But fundamentally, I think we can be proud of our work in the DRC. We've invested very heavily. We were responsible for the first democratic elections there following independence from Belgium. And we see some very positive signs emerging from the DRC in terms of its growth of businesses. Our trade relationships are growing extensively. Our East African businesses and businesses from globally are taking or starting to take advantage of opportunities that are becoming present within the DRC. And we do see this as a positive sign to the DRC becoming an active member of the international political international society. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Mackay. Indeed, I have the benefit of having been there on two East missions some years back. And it was very interesting to go up to DRC and to see its development now. When we went up, it was quite clear that, you know, a war had been here. Buildings were set in were flattened, infrastructure had gone, bridges which had been there going up to the DRC were non-existent. So when anyone had to go up, you know, have some shared cash to pay the people to help build bridges to cross rivers and so on, it was a very difficult thing. Airports, you know, aerodromes were non-existent, getting fuel around. I remember waiting on the top for something like 10 hours or more while army trucks were busy bringing fuel by road for the flight, you know. And one doesn't realize just how much there has been, so that the negotiated peace there, in subsequent elections, certainly they may not think we're at the development phase that they should be, but they are playing a key role in the infrastructure and the energy requirements of Africa. In fact, the Ingaderm, as I'm sure Honourable Mackay is familiar with energy, will play a key role in the region. We signed, I think it was a treaty in October 2013, and we'll be getting, we will also be one of those countries benefiting from hydroelectric energy. It will be the biggest, I believe, dam provide hydroelectricity in the world. It is huge. And really, it just shows that regional integration, like the European Union, working together, countries can benefit from each other, but only if there is peace and security. Only. You can't develop without peace. It's as simple as that. And I think that that is very important, and we need to be mindful that yes, elections are coming up, and to provide the support all of us need to bring about a good government and a democracy that the people themselves can participate actively in. So that is our position on the DRC, and perhaps Co-Chair, you want to comment?
Yes, I see Catherine who would like the floor. She will get it, of course. The DRC, it has struck me that especially in the East, so many people died. And not only in the DRC, but in the whole region, the Great Lake region. Interesting is to see, rightly so, we care about the Middle East, other conflicts taking areas, but there was not this big attention for these atrocities in Central Africa. This part of Central Africa. Why, I really don't know. There were, of course, people who were helping, but it seems that we forgot how many people were killed or injured. It is a good thing that the European Parliament gives credit to those people, doctors and others, who have tried to make the suffering less. And we credit the role of South Africa and of Africa at large in order to bring the blessing back on the road to development and stability. I think a lot has to be done because this huge country is not in peace entirely. So we support your endeavors, and what we can do, we will try to do. I will give the floor to Catherine Beer.
Yes, I'm not sure there's much I can add, but I was also in the Eastern DRC 18 months ago. As we were looking at our legislation on convict minerals and traceability, so I was able to go there and look at artisanal mining. And I think going out, South Africa is big, the Congo, the DRC is huge, and that has enormous challenges for governing a country that is that big. We hear most of the time about the Eastern DRC. We don't hear about the South or the West, which is actually reasonably stable. But they have big challenges and corruption, of course. The further away your governors are, the easier the corruption gets. You know, you haven't got central government looking down your neck all the time. Difficult laws such as diamonds and gold can only be exported to Kinshasa. So you're in the eastern country, the easiest route is to take it out eastwards, but no, everything has to be grown to Kinshasa. You know, so there are challenges there on governance. And when you have an act of governance, of course you have an opportunity there for criminal gangs as well as it's very difficult to know whether is this a military insurrection or is it a criminal activity, and I think that's a very woolly area. But you have corruption and you have criminal activity. They are running guns, they are poaching the wildlife, the elephants, anything that will move, and there is illegal and very dangerous artisanal mining. So what it needs is central and organised Worth Generation to organise that, but a different way of doing things. I don't know if anybody here has seen the film Virunga, but the National Park there is doing terrific work. They are generating more income for the local populations by protecting the wildlife, generating sustainable electricity and water supplies, and outside the parks where chaos is the order of the day. So it has huge problems, and I think it beholds all of us to watch it and to help where we can. But it is, its size is almost its biggest problem, because just connecting with each other is difficult.
Others? Yes, Mr. Sloggan, please. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like very much to underline what you said, Mrs. Chair, about peace dividends. And yesterday, for instance, of course, there is no comparison between what is happening in this country in conflict with what is in Europe. And you know what is the danger now in Europe? That the young generation takes the peace like something which is forever. And yesterday, Polish government just announced they want to increase military expenditure to 2 percentage point of GDP. Romanian government took this decision 6 months ago. Why? Because we feel that the tensions in our continent is growing, and this is a reason. And so Russia just announced yesterday that they build a new supersonic airplane which can break NATO, I don't know what. This is, such kind of developments which we hate. These developments waste our resources. And together we should try to stop this kind of developments everywhere in the world. Otherwise, instead of development, we are spending more and more for military, for defense, and so on.
Thank you. If none of us will agree further, I return the floor to the chair.
Well, on this particular point, we've got chairing Syria, Libya, and Iran. We can continue to chair, but if you'd like to take over the chair, that's fine.
Don't object, it would be good, I think. If we talk about Syria, Madame Fassi, you earlier said that foreign interventions have never brought freedom and democracy. Military interventions, of course. Maybe the only exception could be Japan. We can go into how the situation developed there, but anyhow, what we have seen is that the intervention in Iraq brought about the opposite of what people and governments wanted. I mean, look at Iraq today. There are the minorities, they're in exile or killed. The situation is unbearable, I think, for the people of Iraq. And Iran has a big say in parts of the country. If we look at Syria, also there is a terrible thing which gets to my heart. Years ago, when I was in National Parliament, I led a delegation of the Foreign Affairs Committee to Syria, and unexpectedly we were invited to meet President Assad, the younger President Assad. And he said, "I'm not a Democrat, and you will not like me. But if I'm gone, there will be a person with a beard," and he meant, of course, a very orthodox Tory Muslim. That was what he liked to bring about. We spoke with people of the opposition, human rights advocates. It was possible. I didn't know it, but it was possible. If we look at Syria today, it's in shambles. You can argue whether the moderate opposition had deserved more support or not. But the fact today on the ground is terrible. And we have DESH or IS. If you look what they do to common people, Muslims, other people, it's terrible. If you see the consequences for international cultural heritage, it breaks your heart. Do we have a solution? I'm afraid not really. There is a policy of containment. What could have helped, but then we opened, of course, a can of worms. I think that Russia has always had much influence in Syria. And it could have done more, and it could have retained also in another Syria its military bases. And I hope that Russia would have done so. You know, the Europe, the European Union, the United States, and Russia are at odds now, so it might be further away than ever. However, there is a deal with Iran. And then the United States, Europe, and Russia were able to work together, even though we have outstanding issues. So I think it would be important that we try as international community to improve the situation in Iraq and in Syria. And we should put behind us all differences we have, because if we don't, I think for the next maybe 20 years, maybe even longer, it will be hell on earth in this country and in this region. I would like to give the floor to colleagues who would like to intervene in this matter. If not, then I return the chair to you.
Yes, thank you very much, Co-Chair. You know, I think the important issues here, which we'll also be calling on Advocate Tashimji, also from Durko, but simply to say one comes back, and as you indicated yourself, Co-Chair, that, you know, the intervention, like, has not resulted in what had, you know, been expected, peace, development, and good governance, etc. And to quote yourself, literally a shambles and this kind of thing. And I think this is what, you know, something of weapons in what can only be called unstable areas is always going to be problematic. Indeed, we do support both China and Britain, you know, in this regard here. But the final analysis, we do believe, in line with the United Nations Charter, that it recognized the complexity and diversity in Syria. And the United Nations themselves recognized a military solution was not the way forward for peace and stability. And as you know, South Africa does believe and participate actively in multilateral institutions and bilaterals. And, in a, you know, when one comes back to that, the supply of weapons to forces in unstable areas has never been proved to be successful in achieving a sustainable outcome. It was an interesting point you made with respect to Japan, Co-Chair Hansen Barlin. I know you spent about 4 or 5 years as part of a group there from the European Union that visited there from time to time. So, you know, certainly you do have a real on-the-spot knowledge, understanding probably of the situation there, but I think with your experiences there and the fact that you did make so many visits there, you would also appreciate that the military victory of the United States and others over Japan after the Pacific tide of the Second World War did not result in, as it were, the killing, even by legal process, of the emperor, of the leadership there, etc. Essentially, notwithstanding the United States remained an occupation force for a while, they allowed the governance leadership, if I can put it that way, to operate. That has not been the case after, you know, with the Arab Spring. It has not been the case at all. So when one talks about military intervention, in many ways, you know, I know that my own husband's great study in that direction, he points to the difference of opinion in the United States within advisors to the president. That makes it clear the route to go there would not be what we now see happening in Africa, Arab world, and so on. And the president, the United States president of the day, clearly took the advice. So I think the point to be made about military intervention is that one cannot afford to destroy a sovereign state's governance structures and literally impose, if you like, some African democracy, American democracy, a British democracy, whatever, you know. One needs to nurture the democratic principles within that environment for it to remain sustainable. And I think from what you said the other night, last night, and also during the day, that you would share some of those views. But if I may allow Advocate Cassidy to fill us in there, please.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. I think that the big issue and the greatest tragedy of the Syrian conflict is the humanitarian crisis. If you look at the number of people that have died, the 4 million refugees, it consists of women and children. And people have visited the camps, have narrated horrific stories. And I think the UAE sees this matter, South Africa is very sees this matter, and is calling on the international community to increase its efforts to assist the people of Syria. As our Madam Chair said, I think that there is no military solution to this particular conflict. And based on our own experience of the principle of inclusivity, we believe that all parties have to sit around the table in order to come to a solution. We feel there's no other way. We're also pleased to see that the UN Special Envoy, Ms. Tura, is also beginning to propagate this particular viewpoint, which is in conformity to what we believe. Also, another factor which is very important for us on the continent is the emergence of ISIS. It has an impact on Europe with fights going to Syria. But there are now linkages between ISIS and other terrorist groups on the continent. And you see some of the attacks in Somalia, the tragedy in Kenya. So it is affecting us on the continent as well. South Africa is very fortunate that we have an embassy in Damascus, a fully operational embassy. And in fact, just a few weeks ago, our special envoys were in Syria, where they met with the opposition. And sat around the table to see if they can bring about the negotiations. And obviously, there are complexities within the opposition as well. So basically, from South African viewpoint, this is where we are. We are seized in the latter. We have endpoints that are regularly in touch with the different parties. And obviously, it is a complex matter. And we all hope that we find some way of getting peace in Syria. Thanks, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Advocate Kashimji. Does any other member of the delegation wish to comment? Just looking around. No. In that case, it's over to you, co-chair.
Thank you, dear colleague. We come to a country which is more or less the same state as Syria is, and which has no real institutional backbone. I mean, the Gaddafi regime was not a normal state like Syria was. So it has been very difficult to return to a certain normality. I think that the moment that he said that he would bring death to his opponents, especially in the east of the country, it was hard to do nothing. Also here, you can be in favor of the military invasion or against, but the result is not a positive one. And also here we should see, because it's not only a problem for Libya itself, it's an immense problem for the population of Libya, but it has also opened for those who bring for much money, like an industry, refugees from Central Africa, other parts of the world, through Libya to Europe. It's also opened this problem. So we have to find a solution. And
have received many politicians and NGOs from India. We have to keep on talking and see how we can help the Libyans in establishing a kind of government and a kind of truce. Are there others in our delegation who would like to take the floor? Definitely, please.
I just want to add in this issue of criminality that is feeding into destabilizing so many countries in Central and Northern Africa and the Near East. There are criminal gangs operating. They don't care whether they are moving people, guns, wildlife, drugs, or any combination of those amounts. And they are buying guns and selling them. There are a lot of guns in Africa, far too many guns. And people who want to move, there are even those that will be trading in body parts for transplantation as well as anything you can think of. And charcoal is a huge earner of profit. And I think whilst we have the criminal gangs operating, whilst we're looking, we tend to look at the nation state and see what we can do for that, but missing out that element of criminality, I think, is not going to address the real problem of what is happening across Africa.
Thank you. I return the floor to.
Thank you, Co-Chair. Let me ask Honourable Williams to comment.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just want to say that before the intensification of fighting in mid-2014, the Libyans did ask South Africa for assistance in the reconciliation of their country, as well as in the area of reconstruction, as well as in the areas of national reconciliation. So that did happen, and at a multilateral level, South Africa plays an important role in promoting African Union as a legitimate and important organization and role player for the future prosperity of Libya, the North African region and the continent. At the international level, through the United Nations and other international organizations, South Africa will continue to work towards the reconstruction and development of Libya. As a member of the UN Security Council, South Africa participated actively in meetings meetings dedicated to Libya in an effort to put forward the AU proposals for the resolution of the Libyan conflict. So South Africa is very much involved in this matter and obviously would like to see peace and stability in Africa. And really that is our broad position with regard to all African states. We'd like to see peace and stability, democracy, trade, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Honourable
Williams, is there anyone else who'd like to comment here on Libya? Back to yourself, Churchill.
Thank you. What I earlier said is that indeed it was possible for the European Union, United States, and of course also Russia to work closely together to facilitate a deal with Iran concerning its nuclear opportunities. We have to see, of course, how things develop, but I think that all of us think this has prevented immense problems. We see that the only state that is Israel which is negative on the issue, I myself have good contacts there, so I will go to visit the Israelis in order to see, apart from the statement of Netanyahu, what is their real concern. I can understand, but I think that this has been a successful way of the international community to demine this option. I would like to look at my friends in the delegation whether they want to add or to make a statement. Mr. Zander, please.
Thank you. I think the whole situation about the Iran is a part of the whole region, and we must have a look and the view of the whole region. And I'm coming a little bit back to the Syria, Libya, because it links not only to these countries, but the Israel-Palestine conflict as well. I welcome the agreement between the world powers and Iran about the limiting of nuclear activities in the Iran. And I know what is the biggest complaint from the Israel side. I visited Israel 2 weeks ago and I spoke with the relevant people, especially from the Netanyahu cabinet about it. They are quite comfortable with the agreement from the technical point of view, because we must say that it's from technical point of view that is the agreement which has real oversight over the Iranian nuclear activities. But what is the problem for Israel is the problem that the agreement don't limit the activities of Iran through their proxies in the other part of the region. That is through the Hezbollah, in some Syrian, Syria, especially the Alawites in Syria, and Hamas in Gaza. That is the problem for Israel, because Israel is absolutely persuaded that when the sanctions are lifted, the oil money will spread and will flood to the proxies, and the wars in the conflict will be more bigger, and Iran will try to spend their geopolitical interest in the region. That is the one very important thing, but I think it's linked to the other problem. In reality, when we spoke about Syria or Iraq, this country doesn't exist anymore. There is only on the paper. In reality, there is no Iraq, there is no Syria. It is destroyed, the countries are destroyed, there are other powers which don't accept the borders from the time the old borders were established after 1918, after the Ottoman Empire was destroyed, and all the borders are now not accepted from any power Bashar Assad. He knows very good that he can live on a very small part of Syria, which where the Alawites can dominate, but he knows very good that the other part of the Syria are, from his point of view, are forever not in his hands. And now I'm thinking about the problem of the arrangement. Honorable Williams mentioned the problem of the role of the African Union, for example, and I think we are now challenging the new challenge, and that is that not all the forces respected the borders which were created maybe in some international arrangements, because all the borders are result of the international arrangements, my country as well, or all European countries descend from the arrangements on the international level. That is the same is the case of the Libya. And I think maybe the international community as a whole, United Nations especially, failed. After the conflict, there must be some settlement of the situation with the international guarantees for the borders and for the governments in these countries. And we failed to do that. When we had somewhere a war conflict, when the war conflict will finish, we must make international arrangement with the international guarantee. Without this, the borders and the regimes and the governments will be vulnerable and unstable. And I think that is a challenge for the international community as a whole, not for the European Union, not for the United States. Mrs. Fass many times insisted that the multinational or multipolar arrangement must be here, not unity, that in not only the United States can arrange something. We have to start to work all together to make international arrangements on the multi level, and not to allow only the United States, because they sometimes we are angry on the United States. Why do you have plans in all the arrangements in the world, but on the other international community and the African Union and the South Africa is very important player now in this, in all this issue. We must take it in our hands and do try to make an international arrangement on the level of the African Union or the United Nations. I think it will be very, very important. Thank you.
Mr. Polisana, are there others who want to intervene on Iran, the broader region? If not, I will return to Jim.
No, thank you very much, Co-Chair. I think probably looking back at the Honourable Williams and others, that we have contributed what we wish on the Libyan issue, and then through your chairing we could move and shift, and we are now on Iran. And I think from our side, the South Africans, we welcome the signed nuclear deal. You know, the thing here is always in the implementation, of course. We welcome that deal. But if the deal is successfully implemented, that is the issue here. It could signal good, sound cooperation and peace in the region. And that's what I think we're all saying, that wherever things have occurred, there's a limited stability, if one could even call it a limited stability. And with Iran, it does mean really that it restores Iran's position in the international community. We have, as a country, always maintained that the dispute over the Iranian nuclear program should be resolved peacefully. You will recall that repeatedly South Africa said that. And we do support the goal of nuclear disarmament. We do support that goal by nuclear weapon states. I think that's important. And the creation of a nuclear-free zone, weapons-free zone in the Middle East. We do South Africa, that's our very clear position here. I think that the talks that were held and so on, which included the P5 plus one, I understand that being Germany, the plus one, as it were, that has proved, and we can see, highly successful. And what we would like to see, following what would be a paper restoration of the relationship, we would like to see this actively happening in practice, normal relations prevailing in the region and with Iran's bilateral partners and with their partners on a multilateral level as well. Because that no form of peace holds unless it is multilateral. You do need the united support of world broaders, of the global players, the international players, and that's our position on that regard. I don't think that, just looking around Honourable Williams, as followed by the Honourable Dudley.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just want to raise the issue that I just want to say that South Africa and Iran have got very good relations, and we've had very good relations since 1995, where we established a joint commission, which is chaired by our Minister of International Relations and the Iran's Minister of Foreign Affairs, and meets biannually in each country. So I just want to say that we have a very good relationship with Iran and South Africa. Yes, Chairperson.
Honourable Williams, Honourable Dunn.
Thank you. So the FEEP, of course, also have no problem with the agreement from a technical point of view. And we want to just add to the comment that was made there in terms of that agreement, of course, avoiding any mention of a limited activities as regards to Hezbollah, Hamas, etc. And so we just see that as a huge threat and still very problematic, and the fact that more money could increase that activity. And we will expect South Africa to actually hold them accountable in this area, although we know that South Africa's hands are tied to a large degree in terms of their relationship with Hamas. The AFEEP supports a nuclear-free zone in the Middle East. largely, and we would expect South Africa again to hold Iran accountable in terms of requirements of this agreement. So we will be a part of those South African delegations that will be wanting to see that and that things don't slide under the carpet and have to be dealt with at a later stage. But I do see South Africa's hands being slightly tied because of the South African Hamas kind of connection, and so this is going to be tricky, but the challenge is there, and there will be those of us sitting here that will be determined to hold South Africa accountable in this respect. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Duddy. Thank you, Anit. Over to yourselves, co-chairs, and closing for this section.
Dear colleague Fats, I think also in this case we have been able to discuss without political correctness or taboos. It started, of course, with the ICC, but now we have went to the whole list of troubled areas in the world, in Africa, in Asia, and in Europe, but there are more troubled areas, I think. So we can, with having had this discussion, also use your advice, your knowledge, when we are back in the European Parliament and when we have to discuss the issues and come with resolutions and thought. It is a privilege, and we should also, during this process, communicate with you, you with us, because otherwise we have meetings every 6 months or every year, but in a direct context between you and me, delegations on a person-by-person basis, that is even better. I look forward that not only we have a refreshment, but that we then, after that, come to a draft joint statement, which we will make into a joint statement. I think we have to have some time on both the delegations to study the text, maybe come with proposals, and we have to discuss whether we do this in a plenary way, or another way, but I look forward to this process. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Co-Chair. Yes, I think at this point, let's follow that route and give our support staff a chance just to, you know, finalise the preparation. We've made something which we will simply put in our italics at the moment, bold one line, and we've removed the two paragraphs, which we ourselves are putting, realising that it's a joint statement, not a statement of South Africa's policy per se. So let us not get into it right now because we haven't taken that decision, but we would prefer it if we could take that decision now. And then after refreshment break, we come back, we do proceed in the manner in which you have suggested and proposed, and then have a few photo opportunities of the delegation before proceeding to lunch at 12. Would that be in order? Thank you very much. So let's break for a 15-minute break. Will that be sufficient, Ms. Paulson? Thank you.
We will have a lot of questions tonight.